Hello, Jason. How are you? How are you, mate?
Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with the one and only Nico McBrain from Iron Maiden, who's bringing their Legacy of the Beast tour to Jiffy Lube Live here in the D.C. area on July 24th. Thanks so much for joining us, man.
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you may be listening to this, and whatever time. How the devil are you?
If our listeners have come out to, you know, have seen other Iron Maiden shows, how's this one going to be different to get them out there to a different one? Or what are some of the tried and true, you know, nostalgic staples, their comfort food that they're going to get? You know, what have we got in the set list here?
Oh, well, I'm not going to tell you. You're going to have to come find out. No, that's what do they call that? Spoiler alert. You know, no, I mean, we've already been over in Europe with this tour last year, and it was wild. The stage set is the biggest production we've ever done. It's based loosely based, it's actually quite the foundations are on the Legacy of the Beast mobile app game. And what we've got in relation to the music is the visuals, and we've taken three different realms from the game. And for people that aren't familiar with it, it's basically Eddie goes through this journey through all these different realms, you know, picking up shards and lives and stuff and fighting meanies and whatnot. But we've got the stage set starts off in with a war theme. So we're in a cathedral that's in ruins, and then we go into the actual second realm, which is the cathedral in its all of its glory. And then the third realm is hell within the cathedral. So that gives you a basic idea of where the visuals are going. We are actually, I've got to be honest, this is a massive stage production. And there's a lot of songs that you've heard before that you get the Stable Diet, Hallowed Be Thy Name's back in the set. Iron Maiden obviously closes, Number of the Beast, Trooper. Those are the main stables that you're talking about on the Diet. And then we've got a couple of nice chestnuts thrown in. We've got, for instance, Flight of Icarus. We have not played that song in 30 years. Well, I tell a lie, 29, because we played it last year on the tour. Anyway, it was such an amazing tour last year with the visuals. We've got lots of, we're old school, right? You know that. We don't use what do they call it? Electrons or Tron television screens at the back of us. We got a couple of video screens on either side of the stage, but we're old school with the drapes. We love artwork. We like the artwork to sort of breathe and be real in your face, you know? And so we've got lots of lovely drapes, fantastic fireworks. Only problem is, we let Bruce loose with a couple of flamethrowers.
Oh, God. That sounds dangerous.
If I play a song a little bit too quick for him, guess what I get? It's like toasting a marshmallow, mate. Believe me.
Yeah, don't. You're the Icarus flying too close to the flames.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, yeah, we're really excited about the set list because, as I said, we haven't played Icarus in open. Well, 88, I think, was the last time we played it. It had an airing. We've got Sign of the Cross is out there, The Greater Good of God. That's good to be getting on with, ain't it?
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to read down the whole set list because, you know, some people might not have been online to have a look at the show, you know, from last year and you know, on social media and whatnot, and they might just be like, oh, I want to be surprised. You certainly will be surprised, even if you do know the set list. It's a fantastic tour. We're in rehearsals at the moment because the last time we played together was almost a year ago, August last year. Not quite a year, but, you know, close enough. And so we've been knocking the cobwebs off of some of those songs that we ain't played for a year. Can you imagine what it was like when we got a song we ain't played in 30 years? It's like, what the heck? How's this bit go? You know? Anyway, yeah, it's great. Everybody's going to have a lovely time.
That's awesome. Now, I know the band, they formed, I believe it's Chris, as legend has it, Christmas Day, 1975, Steve Harris at the time. That was before you joined, I think you joined like in 82. Can you recall for us, just from hearsay, I know you weren't there for it, but how that, do you remember, can you tell our listeners how they ended up getting together? I'm sure you've heard that story a million times.
Well, how I got together with the band.
Well, I was going to say first, could you relay what you've heard about how they actually came together and then how you ended up joining up?
Well, no, Steve had the idea in 75 formed a form of Iron Maiden. They worked for a few years with various different players. Dave was always pretty much one of the stable players, so it was Steve and Dave. Then around 1979, they got a record deal. And the lineup was Dennis Stratton, Dave Murray, Paul Di'Anno, and Clive Burr. Clive came in; he did the first three records, as you know. So my actual association goes back prior to my joining the band. 1979, they did their very first European date in Belgium, and. I was playing in a band called McKitty, and we were on the same bill with them. So I got to see Iron Maiden's very first European show out of England. And that was the night when I really, really got to know the band. And that was the beginning, that day that we played the show in Belgium with Iron Maiden and Nazareth were the headline band. Steve saw I did an impromptu drum solo and a bass solo because the guitar player's rig went down. And Steve remembered my solo and said it was one of the best solos he'd ever seen. And he's not a solo guy, as you know. I mean, you'd very rarely ever hear Steve do a solo, and you don't get a drum solo anymore. But that set me up to be the drummer when Clive started, you know, not to play, he wasn't playing too well, his heart wasn't in it anymore. So the first drummer that came to mind was myself. So so boys and girls out there, you know, it's that saying, it's who you know and where you are at the right time. Maybe that's not exactly the way, the saying goes, but I was in the right place at the right time. And it's who I knew, and I'd met the band in 79. So, yeah, the history, they really had their first professional deal in 79, and they went on to bigger and better things. Obviously, as you know, they did the Maiden and Killers album, and Number of the Beast was their breakthrough record, and I joined just after that, and the wonderful late Clive Burr was a stunning friend. He was a great mate and a fantastic drummer. And, he just lost the heart for it. And then I took his drum stool. And the funny thing is, I was playing in a band in 1980 for a couple of years, a band called Trust. And when I left Trust to join Maiden, and Clive actually went and did an album with Trust. That next year, so we kind of swapped drum stools. It's quite a weird story. Not a lot of people know that, and now they do. And I went off, and I've had the drums. I'm the second longest surviving member of Iron Maiden. Would you believe? So it's Steve, Dave, and then me.
Well, thanks.
Bruce. No, not Adrian. No, because both of them had a hiatus from the band, if you remember right in your history.
Right.
And and it's been an absolutely incredible, insane, wonderful, glorious, biting fingernails journey. You know, there's never really been bad times with the guys. Except for when we lost a couple of engines on a very expensive aeroplane a few years ago.
Wait, you got to tell us that story. What is that?
Oh, okay. So we were doing the Book of Souls tour, right? And Mr. Dickinson went off and he learned how to fly a 747 jumbo jet. God, what is he like? Anyway, so this was a few years prior. So say probably around 2013-14, we knew we were going to do another record and we wanted to do another world tour with an aeroplane. And Bruce and I were sitting in a bar in Paris one night, in Bercy, up the road from the gig. And we were talking about it, and I said to him, well, why don't you get a 747 license? And he went, okay, you know, sowed the seed. He went off, learned how to fly a 747. We rented a 747 with a book of Souls World Tour. We were down in Chile, Santiago, and the guys were, apparently, this is how the story unfolds. The guys were actually towing the aeroplane to park it up because we were there for a few days and we had a couple of days off. Then we were doing the show. Then we were going to Curitiba. And I think it was Curitiba, the next gig. Anyway, apparently, when they were towing the aeroplane, when you tow a large, you know, a heavy aeroplane, you put a key in to disable the hydraulics on the front nose wheel so you can actually maneuver the aeroplane without having the power on the engines and, you know, steering it, so to speak. So this is the tug pulls it, the little pin goes in, and the aeroplane goes where you want it to, not where it wants to if you don't have the pin in for the hydraulic disconnect. So what happened was the fellas that were towing it, I don't know whether they were stoned or not, maybe they were, put the wrong key in the nose gear, right? It's like a universal key. It's a 767, 757, and a 747 key. And they put it in the wrong way. Well, about 50 metres before they wanted to turn left to go and park this plane up, the key fell out. Therefore, enabling the hydraulics on the nose. So the tug's turned this 400-ton piece of aeroplane that's now got its hydraulics are back online, and there was no input from the guy upstairs. They were turning it, thinking that they were free and easy, free and clear to turn a plane. Well, the plane went, I'm not going left, and it split. It the nose wheel went straight. It broke the tow bar. The tug fell over on the side. Now the plane has gone straight. Now what happened was, it hit the top of the tug, right, and it pushed the tug in from the outboard left engine into the inboard left engine. Therefore, kind of you know, the nacelle was both, you know, bent up, and the fan blade or whatever completely fucked the engine. Excuse my French. So we're in the hotel, and we get this message that, oh my lord, your aeroplane's got two engines busted on it. So we were only like 3 or 4 weeks, if that, into a world tour, 6 months with the aeroplane, right? Well, 4 months with the aeroplane, I think we did. So they had to send a whole bunch of guys over from Saudi Arabia. Two Boeing guys came down. They had to check the wing spar. They had to get two new engines from Germany that were like $5 million a piece. God knows who had to pay with them. I certainly didn't. I know that. Anyway, so the plane was grounded for like 12 days. They turned it around in 12 days, which was quite a feat, an incredible feat. Especially being down in San Diego and, you know, South America and, you know, we're so far away from, you know, Northern Europe, and the plane was rented from Iceland there. And, you know, so there was a lot of people who had to come in from all points north, south of the compass, you know. So, yeah, that was one of those fingernail moments, you know. But everything else in my life with Maiden has honestly been incredible. The journey is still not done. So, you know, this legacy tour is going to be off and running in week Thursday. We kick off down here in Florida. And, as you said, we're going to be in the D.C. area on the 24th. So for those boys and girls out there listening to this who ain't got a ticket, why not go and get one and come and see us?
That is a that airplane story is freaking amazing. Thanks for sharing that one.
Yeah, my pleasure. I mean, it's one of those moments that when it happened, you know, we had like an army of our, you know, our stage production guy, Patrick, and our tour director and the tour manager and the tour assistant. They all got in rooms and our production lass, Zeb, and everyone that's involved in the kind of running of the band behind the scenes, if you like, you know, at the shows and whatnot, they all got manning the phones. It was like a military operation for 2 days while we had to find another aeroplane for the band to travel from gig to gig. We had to get all the trucks ready to, you know, because we were carrying all of our own equipment under the aeroplane. So all of a sudden, we ain't got the bus anymore. We had to find new transport. So it was a heck of an operation. We got through it.
That's so crazy.
And the plane actually joined us. I think the plane joined us again in São Paulo in Brazil. You know, as I said, 12 days later. So, and then we were off and running again. But yeah, it's been brilliant, mate.
That's great. Before we run, could you? I know your first album was Peace of Mind. They had just done Number of the Beast before, and that was huge. And so you were jumping on a moving train. They were already, you know, they were rocking and rolling. But Peace of Mind was, I mean, arguably one of the better ones. I mean, that had The Trooper, Flight of Icarus. I mean, you jumped on at a great time. Can you take us, just give us an insight, and we're radio, so you have to paint a visual picture a little bit, but when you guys were recording The Trooper the very first time, you're just joining the band, and this is the one you're playing.
Yeah.
Like, that's, just take us, what was that recording studio like when you're doing that?
No, first of all, you got to bear in mind, we were a lot younger, and it was a lot of partying going on, believe me. Celebrations. Okay, so we get in the studio. I think the first track we did, I'm not trying to remember the very first song we recorded. It may have even been Trooper, but I know, okay, Flight of Icarus, right? That was the first single that was released that I played on, right? Trooper came later. So, okay, Icarus, first of all, what we would do is, we would lay a track down, and it was like, right, that's the first track. Let's go and celebrate. Then we go down the local pub up the road, like 20-minute walk, if that, 15-minute walk from the studio. Still there, place called Traveller's Rest in the Bahamas. And we go and get a bit sozzled, and then the next day we'd all be over and go, oh, let's have a day off, go back and get drunk, you know. So then we go back in the studio. We do a couple more songs. We had 4 or 5 songs recorded. And we went, well, that's half a record. Let's go celebrate. We've done half the album, right? Anyway, I remember when we did Trooper, we'd rehearsed that song, and it was written prior to going over to, because some of the songs weren't written. We had to kind of write them in the studio. And when we got Trooper going, I remember as soon as we recorded it, it was like there was an incredible vibe in the room about this is something special. This, and not that they aren't all special, because they are, but there was something extra special about that song. And we thought, this is going to be like an anthem. It's going to be like another Number of the Beast. You know, it's going to be another Prisoner. It's going to be a Hallowed Be Thy Name track, you know?
Right,
And my goodness, it has become so synonymous with Iron Maiden. People, instead of like thinking of those Prisoner and Hallowed, which was like that main stable song through the early 80s, when that album came out, Trooper became like the trademark track, even more so than Iron Maiden itself, the track Iron Maiden, which you're going to get that closes every show. Every time we go and see Maiden. So, you know, we knew we created the Beast of the Beast. And, you know, that, and it's been there ever since. We've got beer named after it. We've always played it. It's the visual artwork of Eddie on top of the horse with the flag and, you know, the charge of the Light Brigade, you know. It's immense, and you know, each song that we played from that record had a story behind it, and that one was just an amazing feeling once we finished the track and we sat back and listened to it, and Martin Birch was the engineer producer of that record, and he was like, oh dear boys, this is just incredible, you know. So we'd opened the lid of the beast can, you know.
Absolutely. You'd unleash the beast.
Unleash the Beast. There you go. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it was great. And of course, my, you know, the opening track was Where Eagles Dare, and you know, to do, you know, we actually, Steve hadn't finished writing that one. He showed us, we did half of the track in Jersey on the Channel Islands. No, not New Jersey, you lot. The Channel Islands, Jersey. Anyway, he'd written about half of that song, and then the rest of it was written in the studio. And of course, the big drum motif at the beginning kind of set me up as the new boy in the band. And of course, then when we went out and did the Peace of Mind tour, what did we open with? Oh, let's open with Where Eagles Dare, Nick. I said, oh, could you give me a few songs in so I could kind of warm up? Because it's a pretty dramatic drum part, you know. Anyway, yeah, so good stories, mate.
Absolutely. Well, you've been more than generous with your time. Yeah, so we appreciate it. Again, it's Iron Maiden Legacy of the Beast Tour, Jiffy Lube Live on July 24th. My wife, Ashley's a huge fan of you guys, so she's going to dig this interview. So thanks, Nico.
Well, you are very well, Jason. Thanks so very much for spending some time listening to this, me yapping on. Loads of love, everybody.
See you.
Ta-da.